All right. So as we start this morning, I do want to reemphasize what Terry touched on 3 weeks ago as he began to introduce us to this book. And I think that most Christians, even those who have not studied Hebrews very much, have might still have an idea as to what this book is about, or how they would answer the question, what is the main theme or what is the main teaching of the book of Hebrews? And of course, the answer might be something like the supremacy of Christ or the superiority of Christ, or perhaps a more childlike answer might be that Jesus is better than everything. And I think I actually like that last answer the best, because that is what Hebrews is about. And I want to start this morning, not in Hebrews, but in Matthew chapter 17. If you want to turn there with me, there's a passage we're familiar with that we may have never connected to Hebrews, but it forms a wonderful introduction, and it's an illustration of what we're going to be looking at in Hebrews that's far better than anything I can think of. So let's turn to Matthew 17. You guys are turning and I'm not. And this is the account of the transfiguration. And we're going to start, I'm just going to read the first 8 verses. "And after 6 days, Jesus took with him Peter and James and John, his brother, and he led them up a high mountain by themselves. And he was transfigured before them, and his face shone like the sun, and his clothes became white as light. And behold, there appeared to them," put my glasses on here, I'm pushing it, "Moses and Elijah talking with him. And Peter said to Jesus, 'Lord, it is good that we are here. If you wish, I will make 3 tents, one for you, one for Moses, and one for Elijah.' He was still speaking when, behold, a bright cloud overshadowed them, and a voice from the cloud said, 'This is my beloved Son, with whom I am well pleased. Listen to him.' When the disciples heard this, they fell on their faces and were terrified. But Jesus came and touched them, saying, 'Rise and have no fear.' And when they lifted up their eyes, they saw no one but Jesus only." That's the theme of this book, is seeing Jesus only. And we'll find out what was happening historically that necessitates the importance of that. So having made this statement that Jesus is better than everything, I would ask this question. And I don't mean to be kind of crass with the way I say this, or don't think me sacrilegious right out of the gate, but when we talk about, Jesus is better than everything, but so what? What does that mean for us? Does anyone not believe that Jesus is better than everything? Who would answer that question, differently? I think when I was a believer in my teenage years, I remember thinking about Hebrews and, reading it. And it starts off, chapter 1 is going to be all about Jesus being better than the angels. And it sort of, as a teenager, my attitude was, of course he's better than the angels. I kind of know this stuff. Doesn't everybody know this stuff? But I think the challenge for us is going to be to really ask ourselves the question, do we really understand what it means that Jesus is better than everything? Because it's not really a theological question. This is not a book like Romans. This is a book that's going to challenge us, because really it's our behavior, it's our responses that will tell us and show us how much we really believe in the superiority, the supremacy of Christ. So that's what this book is all about. Even as I said, even as a kid, I knew that Jesus, the blood of Jesus, was better than the blood of goats and bulls and all those things in the Old Testament. His sacrifice is certainly superior. So the question is, do we even need to be told that Jesus is better? And I think the answer is we absolutely need to be told over and over and over again, as did the recipients of this letter in the first century church. And so there is this expectation throughout all of the scriptures that the teaching and the doctrine contained in the scriptures will change us. You know, as Christians, we study the word not to get smarter, not to just know more stuff, be better theologians and all of that. We study the scriptures that the scriptures might transform us and change us. And that's the challenge for us, is this idea of the supremacy of Christ. How does that change us? What does that work in us? How does that transform our hearts and minds? And I think we'll see that for these first century Jewish converts to whom this is written, they did not fully grasp this idea of the supremacy of Christ. And as a consequence of that, they respond to adversity by grasping for things other than Christ. Because ultimately, any defect in our understanding of this is going to result in us looking elsewhere in times of need. So I would ask the question, are we entirely different than our ancient brothers and sisters? No, of course we're not. But it is a tough question to answer, because most of us don't want to admit that there are other things in our lives that we readily substitute for Christ on a regular basis, though we may not be aware of just how much we do that. And, even later on as an adult studying Hebrews, I still couldn't shake this idea that I'm just studying what I already know. And that's not a bad thing. I mean, my goodness, we ought never get tired of hearing the truth, regardless of how well we think we have learned it. But I'm not sure until I really started studying Hebrews for this class that I had an idea as to what the importance of this book really is. And so one of my kind of thesis points going into this study is that perhaps we don't know from the depths of our being that Jesus Christ really is superior to everything in this life and in the life to come. And I say this, because, such a great truth, frankly, the greatest of all truths, if we understand that, we will be transformed in a way that is spectacular, in a way that would identify us and mark us as belonging to Christ and not this world. So Hebrews is the antidote for this compulsion that we have to turn to the temporal things of this world for comfort, both in times of ease, when times are good. This isn't just about crisis. We sort of lay aside Christ, maybe more so in the good times, when we don't feel like we're in much need of anything, but certainly in times of distress is when this is put to the test. So this is a big deal for the church, the message of Hebrews. And the more I study Hebrews, the more I see a very close relationship with this book and the book of Revelation, which, I think because I taught Revelation, I tend to bring everything back to Revelation. But I think this is really true. I think there's a real partnership in these two books. And frankly, because the church has been really sidetracked and maybe even deceived when it comes to this notion that the book of Revelation is a book of prophecy. It's a book, of predictions about how the world is going to end and all of that. And Revelation does cover the end of history. There's no question. But in a nutshell, Revelation was written to remind us that things in this world are almost never as they seem to be. We look around us in today, in with what we've been facing, and it looks like Satan's gaining ground. Or maybe some people even think Satan is winning. And we've experienced this chaos of a pandemic. We've seen radical change in government. We've seen moral decline. And you can go on and on and on about what we have seen just recently. And it's very tempting to question, what we know about the superiority of Christ. And it's also quite possible to question, is Satan winning? Because on a very worldly level, it may appear that he is. And, what Revelation does for us and why it's such an important book is it sort of pulls back this curtain that keeps us from really seeing what's going on. And it gives us a glimpse of how things really are today. Christ is already victorious in his kingdom. Satan has already been defeated at the cross. The elect continue to be called to faith, by the power of the gospel, without fail. And certainly one day there will be a new heaven and a new earth where Christ's victory will be fully seen. We will see it. We will understand it. That's Revelation in a nutshell. That's what that book is about. So what is the connection with Hebrews? Well, it's a strong connection because the believers to which Hebrews is written, they just don't see it. That's their problem. They're in a time of adversity, and the things that the author of Hebrews is writing about is something they're not grasping. And there's a temptation on their part to go back to what they once knew. In their case, they're Jewish converts. So they're not just reaching for, pagan gods and New Agey kind of things, as we would say today. They're going back to what they knew. They were going back to the inferior things of Old Testament religion that were never meant to be the answer, the final. So that's the connection with Hebrews. They're starting to experience persecution for their faith. And we'll talk a little bit more about this, how much persecution they were enduring and all of these things. But as they start to deal with persecution on all fronts, their own people, they're not welcome in synagogues. They're being excluded from Jewish life. It's affecting their businesses and all of these kind of things. The problem is, for many of them, Jesus is not enough. And so that's driving them to seek something else. They're not seeing clearly. So the writer of Hebrews is going to walk us through this. It's not just a statement that Jesus is superior. He's going to, very painstakingly show us many, many ways in which Christ is superior. So Hebrews chapter 2, verse 6. See, I'm skipping already. Terry said he was going to start from the back of the book and work forward. And I'm going to start in the middle of the book. Yeah, but I think this is an important verse for us. Hebrews chapter 2, verse 6 begins with a quotation of Psalm 8, which reads, "What is man that you are mindful of him, or the son of man that you care for him? You made him a little lower than the angels. You have crowned him with glory and honor, putting everything in subjection under his feet. Now, in putting everything in subjection to him, he left nothing outside of his control." And he's talking about Jesus. It's interesting. Yesterday, I was supposed to be preparing for this class, and I have a tendency to get caught up reading other things that like chapter 2. I don't know why I was in chapter 2 yesterday. But I was literally sitting there just reading over this, and Terry texted me and just said, is there anything in Hebrews you want to talk about? I could tell he wanted to talk. And I texted him back, and I said, you know, this is what I'm reading, and it's this last statement that now putting everything in subjection to him, he left nothing outside of his control. And you know, that's a powerful thing. And if we truly believe that and could understand that, things like pandemics take on a whole new meaning. Things we see in our government, things we see in our families with our kids and with our health, and you know, you can go on and on and on. That's what Hebrews is about. It's about making us understand, you know, these truths. And it's not hyperbole. You know, when he says everything is subject to him and everything is under his control, that's not just dramatic exaggeration or anything like that. There is nothing outside of his control. And, you know, I think as you know, Presbyterians and people with Reformed backgrounds, you know, we know that. I mean, there are people who I've had discussions with that frankly don't believe everything is under God's control. They would say things like sickness, you know, that's just not something God has much to do with. He can heal, he can do miracles, but you know, does he have a hand in lymphoma? Yes, he does. He does. And if we don't, if we there's a reason I picked lymphoma.
Was that an amen?
But you know, again, this goes back to Revelation. That's what Revelation is about, is to tell us that this chaotic world is not, it's not chaos. It is in his control. It sure looks like chaos to me. There's no question about it. And there's times that you know, it does not look like God has much to do with something. You know, tornadoes and that rip churches apart. You know, but yeah, it's a difficult concept for us. And so for the believers in the first century, you know, this means Nero. You know, one of the most wicked of men who have ever lived, you know, he is under the thumb of the Lord. And, you know, this means American politicians, even those who dismiss God's law, they are subject to him. So the question is, do we really believe it? Well, of course we do. But do we? So I see Christians, you know, people I've interacted with over the last year in this pandemic, and I've talked about this before, that are so gripped with fear.
Yeah.
And you know, there's this phrase that's going around, faith over fear. You know, that it's a buzz phrase. It's a bumper sticker. It's not that simple. You know, our fear is real. We don't just dismiss it by saying, well, faith over fear. You know, we dismiss it by digging into the scriptures and letting the scriptures reveal to us that we don't have to be afraid. But I have been struck by, you know, the Christians that I interact with daily, how many of them have just slipped into this fear. Some of them, their personalities have changed. It's as if they've forgotten all that they know. It happens. That's what happened to these early Jewish believers. They're forgetting what they know to be true. And so, there are things out there in this world that scare me. We all have things that scare us, for sure. And so I'm not suggesting that there's no room for fear in our lives. We're not talking about that. But we're talking about letting fear grip us and letting fear divert our attention from what we know to be true, so that we start looking for other things. And you can all you know, fill in the blanks for what those other things are. It's a list a mile long, and it's different for all of us. But it's very, very easy to be tempted to start looking for something other than the fact that Christ is Lord over all. And so we need a glimpse of Christ as he is. And that's what Hebrews is going to show us. That's what Revelation shows us, is it pulls that curtain back and said, this is Christ. You know, we have this picture in our head of who Jesus was when he walked the earth. We don't see him as a roaring lion, sitting at the right hand of God the Father. Hebrews is going to remind us, you know, who our Savior is and what he looks like and why he is so great. And so it's so important to me that we start this study with the right biblical mindset. Let me skip that. So we looked at Matthew chapter 8 and the Transfiguration. And I do think that there's this strong connection between that picture and what we're talking about today. So the disciples in that passage, they see Jesus. They've been walking with him. They presumably, they feel like they know a lot about him and maybe who he is. And then all of a sudden, they see this picture of him transfigured into something much closer to the reality. It's a powerful image. And it reminds us that he is both God and man. They've been walking with Jesus, the man. Now they're seeing him as God. And in this powerful image, Moses and Elijah appear with him. And of course, Moses and Elijah, in the scriptures, they represent, the religion of the Old Testament. They represent true religion. These are truly, heroes of the faith. And so the problem is for the disciples, they're looking and they see Jesus and these two heroes. They're seeing three heroes. These are the superheroes of their life. And we see this in Peter, where Peter's, this is fantastic, this image. How about I build a tent for each one of them? You know, let me build a statue of each one of you, because now we've got it all. It's now complete. And, as the story goes on, Peter has no idea how wrong he is. And we're told, and I think this is kind of funny, that while Peter's mouth is still moving, because his mouth is apparently always moving, the Lord comes to them in a bright cloud that overshadowed them. So they don't really see what's happening. And a voice, the voice of the Father, appears and says, "This is my beloved Son, with whom I am well pleased. Listen to him." And then what? They can see again, and these two men are gone. Their heroic trio has been whittled down to Christ. And the disciples, of course, they drop to the ground and they cover their faces in fear. And Jesus touches them and they stand. And it says they have no fear as they stand. And here is the climax and the connection that we're looking for in verse 8. They lifted up their eyes, and as I read before, they saw no one but Jesus only. And, there's no need to turn to the fathers of the faith, the prophets. God the Father announces this himself. His most excellent Son has come, and he alone is who they are to listen to. And what a great connection with the first two verses of Hebrews chapter 1. Let me read these. Starting in verse 1, "Long ago, at many times and in many ways, God spoke to our fathers by the prophets. But in these last days, he has spoken to us by his Son, whom he has appointed the heir of all things, through whom also he has created the world. Saying the exact same thing. That, you know, yes, these are great men of the faith, but in these days, he has spoken to us through Christ, and he could have left it there and said, this is my beloved son in whom I am well pleased, but he throws in this, you know, through whom the world was created. I mean, there's a picture of power that we're going to see throughout Hebrews where it's not just telling us that we need to stay focused on Christ. It's revealing this picture of who Christ is, because it's a lot easier to do that. And that's why I think, you know, probably in my Christian life, studying Revelation has affected me more than anything else, because I have images in my head of how things really are. You know, and I have, you know, images of Christ as you know, the conquering lion. Just things that we don't think about on a day-to-day basis. And I hope that Hebrews really kind of supports all of that as well. And so this is where background and context become really important. You know, we need to understand in a general sense who this book was written to. We're never going to know the specifics, because the writer of this book does not identify his exact audience, nor does he identify himself. And as Terry pointed out, 3 weeks ago, there's not even a greeting in this book. It's a letter, but it's unlike all the letters of the New Testament. There's just no greeting. A very unusual thing. There's no shout out to others, you know, right up front. And, you know, some books they'll say, hey, so-and-so says, hey, you know, it's like a letter. And we just don't see any of that here. And it almost seems like the writer has no interest in making a personal connection or establishing his authority. That's another thing that we see, especially in Paul's letter. In fact, Hebrews is more of a sermon. And I think Terry pointed that out as well. Commentator Dennis Johnson, he says that he actually took the book and read it in Greek out loud as a sermon. And he said it took about 45 minutes, and it would make a great 45-minute sermon. And I agree with the New Testament scholars who observe that this anonymity that we see is really part of the theme of the book, which is, let's not be distracted. I didn't want to tell you up front, hey, this is Paul or whoever. Let's not get distracted with that. Let's get right into the theme of this. Because, you know, the early church, like the church today, had celebrities. You know, Paul was like royalty in the early church. Peter was more like a rock star. I mean, he's a celebrity, but very different than Paul. And it's very easy for them to say, okay, we're not going to cling to Elijah and Moses anymore. Now we have Paul and Peter. You know, and a lot of that went on. There were Paul had to remind people at times, you know, you guys say, I'm of Paul, I'm of Apollos, and you know, that's just our human nature. We follow people. And there's no room for anything like that in the book. So, you know, as I said, Paul was would have been a celebrity, as would Peter. But the situation of the believers to whom this is written really demands that all of that gets stripped away if they're going to get set on the right course again, so that Christ alone would, you know, captivate their hearts and their minds. And I'm not going to spend a lot of time on the theories about who wrote the book. The church father Origen, he addressed this issue way back in the year 215. And he was talking about this very thing, who wrote the book. And in his day, it was very popular to think that Paul wrote it. And he says he doesn't think this is the case, but he's very famously quoted often for saying, God only knows who the author was. I mean, there's no way to know for sure. The Eastern Church, when the church split into Eastern and Western, the Eastern Church almost exclusively accepted Paul as the author. The Western Church did not. There's a whole list of candidates. Terry talked about some of them. Barnabas, Silas, Priscilla, even Luke, although I think that's probably unlikely. Many think that it is somebody in the Pauline circle. That whoever wrote this probably had much to do with Paul. But honestly, today, the vast majority of modern scholars say that it's unlikely that Paul wrote it. But there are notable exceptions. R.C. Sproul believes that Paul wrote it. It doesn't matter. If it mattered, they would have introduced themselves.
Yeah.
And, you know, because for Paul, it did matter when he introduced himself, because he was trying to establish his authority and those sorts of things. So I would love for it to be Paul, just because I love Paul, you know. I follow Paul. He's my hero. You know, the other reason that I would like it to be Paul is I'm going to get really tired of saying the author of Hebrews. The author of Hebrews says. I would rather just say Paul says. So we could make up a name. Chuck. As Chuck says. But in any event, we don't know. So there is a reference to Timothy toward the end of the letter. And there are certain passages that we're going to see that do kind of remind us of Paul along the way. But on the whole, you know, the scholars say that the Greek isn't Paul. Paul wrote with a very common form of Greek. His language was actually very, very simple and common. And Hebrews is written with a much more sophisticated, you know, Greek style. One argument against Paul is a significant one that's found in chapter 2, where the writer says that this message that he's bringing was attested to by those who heard, meaning those who heard either from Christ or from the apostles. And that's interesting, because what is Paul always really careful to say about his messages? I didn't get this from anyone else. You know, he always says the exact opposite of that. We see that especially in Galatians. He always says he was not received from the apostles. And we also know that Paul was not an eyewitness to Christ. So again, we just don't know. I do think it's more important to know who the audience is in where they resided. Because the context of knowing what was going on, I think, helps us understand the applications that we're going to make that are kind of scattered throughout the letter. In fact, that's another difference with Paul. Paul has a typical structure that he writes with, where he's very heavy in theology in the beginnings of his books. And then towards the latter half of the letters, I should say, he starts to get into application. And it's just the way he communicates. It's his style. And that's not the style of Hebrews. Hebrews is full of these pastoral exhortations right from the beginning. And they're just evenly scattered throughout the entire letter. So, you know, maybe this is some evidence that it's not Paul. But I think what I'm going to do, rather than get too deep into I'm going to do maybe another 15, 20 minutes on some of the historical aspects of who the recipients of this were. And then next week we're going to get into chapter 1, which is largely about Christ's superiority over the angels. And presumably, you know, as these Jewish believers start going back into their Jewish roots, into their Jewish religion, there's a great emphasis on angels in the Old Testament. Remember how Hebrews starts. God says, in times past, I spoke through the prophets, and he used angels as well. Angels came to people. They communicated things. And so they may be getting more back into the religion of angels in those sorts of things, which we even see rear its head in Christianity today. From time to time, people get a little obsessed with rediscovering angels, who they are and what they do, and all that sort of thing. So, you know, I think it's significant that he starts with angels, because angels can be pretty impressive creatures. I mean, there's some amazing images in the Old Testament of how magnificent angels are, and as we will see going through that chapter, as magnificent as they are, they don't hold a candle to Christ, because Christ created them. He created all things. That's going to be a theme for us. You know, we tend to think of God as God the Father as the architect and the creator, but the scriptures say over and over and over again that all things are not only created by Jesus, they're sustained by him. You know, the fact that we continue to exist moment by moment, again, testimony to his greatness, something that should, in times of trouble, who would you turn to? The person that created all things and sustains all things? But again, our sinful nature is, now maybe there's something better. Maybe there's a self-help book or even a good Christian book. You know, it doesn't have to be a self. This isn't about turning to secular, obvious, you know, pagan things. We turn to other things in the church. You know, we've all got our functions in church, and we can bury ourselves in teaching, you know, rather than deal with the truth of Scripture. Sounds crazy, but it's easy to do. But I'm going to stop there this week. Any comments as we start? I think this is going to be a very practical study for us. I really do. And I have to confess that I never thought of Hebrews as a practical book. I knew it wasn't a theological book like Romans. You know, I never looked at it that way. I guess I never knew where Hebrews really fit. And I'm not alone in that. Luther didn't know what to do with Hebrews either. And of course, Luther had that problem with a number of things. He, you know, if it was up to him, we wouldn't have the book of James and even Revelation. That's, you know, he took all the books that he didn't know what to do with, and in his Bible, he stuck them all at the end together. If he didn't know who wrote it, he stuck it at the end, and, you know, all of that sort of thing. So,
did you say you were going to try to record the lessons?